Well, the
The Subcommittee on Human Services of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means today is May 6th. I'm opening a public hearing. The public hearing on House Bill 5043 is open. Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Authority Budget Rebalance. Ms. Byerly, please give us a preview.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, before you today are a couple of things. The first item on the agenda is our rebalance presentations from both agencies, and we have a bill for you today that will be the vehicle to implement those rebalance adjustments to the current biennium's budget. So we will have them present their information, we'll give you, and then we will open a work session to complete action on that bill. And then the second part of the meeting is some information for you on 2015-17 caseload projections. It's to provide you some background as we move into working more in depth on the 15-17 budget. These are caseload projection adjustments that we'll have to build in going forward. So we're having them share that information today in preparation for action on the next biennium's budget at a later date.
Okay, thank you. So will the presenters please come on up?
And while they're coming up, so in OLIS today, you have two presentations for the rebalance, one from each agency. There's a rebalance recommendation memo from Linda and I in the OLIS as well, as long with two presentations for the informational portion of the meeting and a copy of the amendment to House Bill 5043 for the rebalance.
Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Nathanson and Bates, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal. I am the director of the Department of Human Services.
Good morning, Co-Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Eric Moore. I'm the CFO for DHS.
I know we have a packed schedule today, so we'll move forward quickly. We come before you today with our third rebalance of the biennium. We are balanced. We have presented a balanced plan for you. It does require that you take some action, including a shift of some program savings from the a request that you shift some program savings from the Oregon Health Authority to the department. Importantly, we have been able to come in balanced, even with some cost overages in parts of the budget, which we'll go through with you, due to some management actions and savings that we're recommending that you apply to the budget overall. We did have caseload changes and drivers as the primary unanticipated costs since the last time we were in front of you in December, and those primarily present for you as costs in the Aging and People with Disability and the Developmental Disability Programs. This is a table just for your reference that shows you the puts and takes for each of the program areas, where the costs are, where the savings are. We'll go into it in a little more detail as we move forward, and again, in summary, not making a new general fund ask of the committee today, are able to come in balanced with that transfer of resource. We do have other fund and federal fund limitation requests also, though, put forward as part of the plan. So we'll focus first on the Aging and People with Disabilities program area. We spelled out for you in the slide where where the cost drivers are happening in that program area. As you can see here, largely in the in-home program, we've been talking about this with you. We talked about it during our overview presentation, really driven by two policy changes that were made in the 13-15 biennium, the implementation of the Community First Choice Option K plan, and also the change in policy that was made with regard to the amount of income that individuals who are receiving, I want to call it the right acronym so I don't misstate it, but individuals who are receiving SSI, Social Security income, are able to then keep. We believe that those two things are driving the in-home caseload and the costs that are associated that you see here. We also have in our community-based care some caseload, a small amount of caseload increase, and then an increase in the actuarial projections for the program for the all-inclusive care for the elderly, the PACE program, so some cost per case increases in the CDC program area. And then,
did you have a question?
Just a quick question. On the in-home care for SSI recipients, new ones, we've seen a real increase in this across the nation during the recession. most of these people appear to be unable to work because of medical or other issues, but they can take care of their activities of daily living. And the decision to allow them to keep more of their money and to give them minimum care from relatives or friends is one of the things I think is driving us, along with the caseload increase because of the recession. We'd like to have a little more information on that. We understand that may be one of the drivers. I don't remember how that decision was made. Was it a decision made by the agency, or was there a bill that actually was involved in which legislators stepped up and said, we want to do this? How did that come about?
Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson, members of the committee, that was a decision that was part of the budget process very explicitly with the legislature in the last legislative session. It was part of the larger conversation about the desire to take advantage of the increased revenue that was available in the K-Plan and where some of the program cuts had been made during the deeper parts of the recession and earlier in the biennium, and where people wanted to make changes to go back the other direction. Just by way of small reminder as well, to qualify for those in-home services, there still must be limitation for those individuals in terms of their activities of daily living. They still must qualify for long-term care services and supports in the in-home program here. In this cost bucket, what you see are people who do still meet those service priority levels that we went through with you during the overview for the Aging and Persons with Disabilities budget.
Follow up. If we decide to tighten that up and close that door, will we run into issues with the federal government on the K waiver?
Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson, I want to defer to Mr. McCormick, who's in the audience and can talk about that either now or during the caseload forecast presentation, where this shows up again in terms of the increase in the in-home program.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Mike McCormick, director of the Aging and People with Disabilities Program. If we were to revert to our previous policy, that would require a negotiation with CMS. I don't have an estimate of the likelihood of them approving that policy change, but we're certainly able to engage in those negotiations with CMS.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let's continue.
A quick one. I want to
just quickly.
Next point.
What's the if you looked at that category, what is the and the spike? What is the age span in that group? Under 65, over 65. What?
Co-chair, Senator Winters. I was just looking at this data this morning. New entrants to in-home care is dominated by individuals aged 50 to 69. They exist in all age categories, but that is the majority of the growth is in that age range.
Okay, let's move on. In addition to caseload, we did have two program reviews in this area that resulted in some cost increases. Also, those are the references you see on the page to the MOE finding and the Disability Determination Services finding. These are some course corrections that we need to make programmatically around cost allocation and maintenance of effort. On the other side, the program has been looking for ways to apply savings to the challenges that it's facing. There are estimated savings based out of the special purpose appropriation in terms of dollars that have not yet been spent. We do appreciate that you have been having some conversations with some advocates about what to do with savings in the special purpose appropriation. Is it more appropriate to apply them to the general rebalance or to other things such as the wait list that we know exists around the senior property tax deferral? Because the agency needed those savings in order to balance the budget, we applied them here in our proposal, but that's certainly something for you all to consider and discuss. Other savings that is on the page relates particularly to Project Independence and program savings. These were programs that have been the second bullet in terms of OPI. This is based on current spending projections. I will make a note that there is risk here. If the spending does increase before the end of the biennium, then we would not have that savings accrue to the budget. So that is a risk in terms of putting this up forward for you all as a savings option. and in terms of other program savings. Simply in this program area, we had quite a bit of new program this biennium that we were launching. Some of it was slower to launch, and that's and hence the program savings that you see that we're recommending be applied to the cost increases. Throughout the department, you'll see us reference that we've continued to be really careful in terms of our personnel management. We've carried this forward throughout the biennium because we did have personnel cost increases that weren't anticipated when the budget passed due to bargaining. And then in addition, this is really our primary lever for balancing the budget. When we start to see the budget increases in the caseload, we do become very vigilant around our position management so that we can use that in a way that tries to balance the need and the directive that you've given to us around getting staffing up and running to get the results that we want, and then also managing the budget appropriately given the cost increases.
When you say managing staffing, does that include holding vacancies open?
Co-Chair Nathanson, it can. We're not in a hiring freeze. We don't have a particular designated period of time or anything like that. But we are just carefully managing all positions before they are posted for hire.
Could you talk a little bit about the confidence level you have in the savings? Some of these savings are, as you've indicated, well, there are choices that we can make, but if we don't use one kind of savings, we have to look for something else because we do have to balance your budget. But how confident are you that those savings either have accrued or will accrue in the time span that you're planning on for the budget period?
Co-Chair Nathanson and Bates, there is risk, I think, particularly around the special purpose appropriation and the OPI savings that are here. This is based on our independent review of the costs accrued to date and a projection of the spend pattern should the spend pattern continue. There's risk, I think, always by calling attention to it that people accelerate their spending because we've noted it here as something that we're trying to save, and because technically speaking, there are contracts out there that take advantage of the revenue that is in the budget. So I think the places where the highest risk is in terms of these savings options are in those first two bullets.
Thank you. Chair.
Yes, really simple question. I'm sorry. What does SPA stand for?
Special Purpose Appropriation. Let's move on to the next slide.
This slide outlines for you in some detail which parts and where in the developmental disability and intellectual disability services we're seeing case increases, caseload increases, and costs. Again, we've talked about this at length, I think, during our subcommittee hearings before now in terms of the opening up of that caseload and the entitlement through the community first choice option. Lifting caps that previously were there, and also opening programs for children in particular that previously were waitlisted programs. It's been very difficult to forecast that caseload accurately. When you have big shifts in policy, like the community first choice option that impacts so significantly program design, it's very difficult for our forecasters to anticipate because we don't have a way of tracking people who are not in the system and are not coming to us volunteering for services always. And those wait lists had existed for a really long time. And so, as you know, over time, people pull themselves off of them or they don't even sign up because they know they won't get service. So we do appreciate that there's been volatility in this caseload. It's been a tough one to predict. In the support service savings in this budget, we did have in the personal support worker program savings both in terms of workers' comp and health. Again, these were new programs, new benefits that were created in the last legislative session, and the utilization of those just has not kept pace with the budget projections, so there are some savings in this budget area as well.
Thank you.
This slide highlights for you where the savings are in the budget that help us to balance the APD and the DD cost overages that we have, both in self-sufficiency and in child welfare. I know we have a lot to cover today, so I'm happy to take any questions. I know you've read the rebalance report, but I guess the thing I would note is that we did have cost overages in the self-sufficiency area in the employment-related daycare program. People are buying higher, more expensive care, and they're also staying on the program longer, which means they're keeping their jobs. The turnover rate for families is less on the ERDC program. In this case, the savings from TANF and employment outcomes and getting people off the program actually offset the employment-related daycare cost increases, and then some, and so you see that here on the page. Again, we have the staffing management actions, and we had the ability to draw down more federal contingency funds for the TANF program that we used to move general fund over to cover other costs. Child welfare continues to see foster care caseloads decline, we are predicting some savings in the child safety programs as well. And finally, we did have a federal review of our 4E claiming process, and we were under-claiming, particularly in adoption assistance, and so we're anticipating the ability to draw down more federal funding in 4E for adoption.
On foster care caseload dropping, is that because there are fewer children going to foster care, or they're staying in foster care less time, or both?
Co-Chair Nathanson and Senator Bates.
As far as being able to reflect it in savings, which I'm guessing it might be some of both.
Chair Nathanson, Chair Bates, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Lois Day. I'm the Child Welfare Director at the Department of Human and Services, and we believe it's both, that we're able to return children quicker when placed, and we're preventing placement.
Thank you.
And really, this is just a summary slide that gives you the overview of our overall position. And with that, I'll take questions and wrap up.
One last question, and then we'll move on to the next.
Because if we're tight on time, I'll hold it for another time. Concerning the RDC, we'll get to it later.
Oh, indeed we will. Thank you. Let's move to the next. Everyone's noticing an unusual amount of discussion between me and Legislative Fiscal Office staff. It's because I'm trying to be paperless and rely on access to electronic information, and it's not accessible on my computer.
And so mine gave out today, too, so I'm down to paper again. So I couldn't get it to come up. So.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, under OLIS, you'll see House Bill 5043, Oregon Health Authority presentation. I know there's several documents up.
It's easy.
Ready?
Yes, thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Bates and Nathanson, Lynn Saxton, Director of the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm joined today by Bill Colum, our Budget Director, and Kate Nass, what hat are you wearing today, Kate?
Today, excuse me, Kate Nass with Department of Administrative Services, Chief Financial Office.
Full disclosure, she has joined the Oregon Health Authority team, so she's wearing lots of hats. We bring to you today the rebalance documentations. We sent previously our letter describing the rebalance and the efforts and the results. I'm going to let Bill kind of go quickly through what the numbers tell us. It's pretty concise and pretty clear, I think, from the slides.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Bill Colum, Budget Director of the Oregon Health Authority. Our general fund savings are primarily attributed to the change in the MAP caseload, medical assistance program, and reflect a significant increase in our ACA population, where the cost per member is actually calculated. As we get later into our slide presentation here, as well as when we do the caseload update on the informational hearing, you'll see that when we do an isolation of change, it shows how the mix of the OHP population is moving from one category to another. While this increase was anticipated as part of our December rebalance, the continuation of ACA enrollment levels continues into this rebalance, and we do have two variables that are affecting this, which you're of course aware of, and that is that as we continue to work through our redetermination backlog, as well as a delay of some closures. The other element, of course, in the detail of our rebalance is that there's a small challenge associated with assessments and enterprise costs. These increases were not associated with the December rebalance, but the agency learned of them late December, so they are now incorporated into this update. Our savings for the rebalance, again, are significantly attributed to the MAP caseload in the cost savings, where we have an offset of $63 million in general fund. When you look at the slide of both the general fund and the total fund mix, this sort of helps reinforce the attribute of where people are moving into the ACA category, which is why we have a total fund increase of about $25.4 million. We also show a net savings to general fund of $1.1 million for the most recent tobacco tax revenue forecast. Now, in the total fund column, it'll look confusing because you see a zero there, but that's simply in our budget, we offset that into the other fund column. We have a small savings, excuse me, we have a small, excuse me, I'm losing my voice. We have a small savings associated with the addictions and mental health area of the budget, and this is directly attributed to a specific appropriation under House Bill 2836. This is what was known as the Juvenile Fitness Determination Bill. The agency was allocated approximately $900,000. Now, due to the startup of that particular thing,
Bill's been working extremely hard.
Excuse me. So due to the delay in the startup of the anticipated program for House Bill 2836, we're not going to be able to spend down that specific appropriation by June 30th. The courts have now started to utilize this option, and we haven't seen some of these the uptake in the utilization until December of 2014.
I'm going to give you an opportunity to take another sip of water if you'd like and ask a question. The tobacco tax forecast, I've been reading statistics about a decrease in tobacco use among young people. Of course, there's a corresponding increase in obesity, which is unfortunate. Not that those two are connected. But I'm curious about this tobacco tax estimating an increase in revenue. Is that what you're indicating here?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. We base our budget on the revenue forecasts that come out each quarter from the Office of Economic Analysis, and then we adjust the budget for those, whether it goes up or down. You'll see later, as we have presented in prior rebalances, this volatility, of course, always remains a risk to our budget, and again, of course, is based upon the actual sales and consumption. So as those revenues either go up or down, we have to backfill it or take away from our general fund bucket.
So in this kind of forecast, are the economists looking only at historical patterns and what the most recent trend is, or are they also taking into consideration programs that we have that we've either discontinued or restarted or expanded, for example, prevention or tobacco cessation. Are they taking any of that into account, or is it just strictly looking at the history?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the variables that are accounted for in the economic forecast, I would need to have the state economist speak to. I don't really know what elements they look at. We receive the data, of course, from a revenue perspective.
I'm just trying to figure out for my own confidence level. Is this Is this a good number or not? Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I will note if you look at tobacco tax forecasts, like for the health plan, for 15-17 compared to 13-15, it is a little lower.
Okay.
So they are accounting for a decrease in those distributions over time, and that's probably partly due to these kind of effects. But remember, we also increased the rate in order to do the mental health piece, and so it may mean that less is going to other programs.
Okay. Good. I feel comfortable about this.
I'm glad you asked
action.
That question. I had exactly the same one, Madam Chair, when I read the rebalance report.
Thank you.
And then again, there the picking up where we left off in regard to savings, there is a small savings for the enhanced care outreach services. This is a partnership that we had with Department of Human Services during the 13-15 biennium, in which Addictions and Mental Health was originally slated to put into place the processes as far as license settings that basically provide stabilization for persons sitting in or residing in long-term care services. Because of the criteria for the program was late in getting started, the necessary amount is built into our 15-17 budget, but because this is money that we will not be spending in the current biennium, we do have a savings that is transferred or proposed to be transferred to DHS, as Aaron Kelly Seal presented in the DHS presentation.
Before we get to case study, that's
yes, Senator Bates.
The real money in this is the rate setting. You kind of went past them very quickly. We got a discussion about what I think are rounding issues. The real issue here is caseload. Original expectations were that we would hold the caseload costs down to a 3.4% maximum each year for the next 2 years. That's what we had agreed with the federal government on. We, in fact, have lowered our caseload cost by 1 percentage point going into this year. It happened Christmas Eve and was reported out Christmas Eve and told sign your contracts and get back in. That's hotly debated what we're going to be doing with that. And I know you're doing a restudy of those now, getting ready to reset those. Those numbers aren't going to be available until probably we're out of here in July, is my understanding. No one knows what that's going to look like for sure. It's very political as well as being very real. I'm hoping we'll have better numbers to look at with more history behind it. If that is to continue, there may be other repercussions as far as CCOs surviving that or not surviving that. They have big reserves right now. But the caseload, as we expected, is starting to go back up again. I want to know what you think the backlog looks like right now because of the electronic problems we've had getting people in. And secondly, if that caseload does go up, even with these lower rates, what that means to the entire program.
Do you want to start? Co-chairs Nathanson and Bates. We are watching the mechanics of the healthcare system with great intensity right now. We're very cognizant of the interplay between the caseload projections, the rates, the retained earnings or reserves. And I think we feel confident that we are watching all the parts of the machine, and I think we're also confident that we have enough lead time to make corrections and to bring critical issues forward so that the system is financially sustainable. I think one of the things that has happened with the redevelopment of the 2015 rates is that we have a heightened awareness and greater clarity at all in all of our partners, including the CCOs, about the various I don't want to use the word tipping points, but the various elements and the role they play in sustainability. So that's not a we've got it, it's handled, and we're moving forward. But it is a very clear reassurance to this committee that we understand the parts of the machine and we are being very careful not to upset elements that can cause lack of sustainability. I do want to say that the scope of the data in terms of how much we might be off with the redeterminations, the failures to close, et cetera. We're also getting closer and closer on those numbers as we have improved our enrollment process. Again, I don't have a hard and fast number for you today, but we watch that weekly because we're very much aware of the role it plays in the sustainability of the program.
Just want to be sure that when we leave here, we understand that there's a huge risk in this program. We don't know the caseload, and we're not going to know a cost as far as rates are concerned before we leave. We may come back in February and have a real problem on our hands. Just be aware of that.
Senator Steiner, it's maybe perhaps marginally off topic, but I would point out, apropos of Senator Bates' comments, that we have the potential of reviewing in the subcommittee Senate Bill 845, which would require the Department of Employment and the Health Authority to work together and the Department of Human Services to work together to determine people who are employed and yet still receiving state benefits. And part of the caseload relates to people who are working part-time at multiple jobs, but none of them is going to give them benefits because they're not working full-time at any of them. And I think we need to look hard at our caseload in that light in the long term, and we may have an opportunity to do that because I remain concerned about that issue, and I know it's something that Ms. Saxon and her team have thought about as well.
Right. Co-chairs Nathanson and Bates, I do want to underscore, too, as we pointed out in our letter, the agency itself has a thorough restructure underway to ensure that we are battening down the hatches, if you will, in terms of the turbulence in the external healthcare environment and being prepared to address that.
Continuing on with in regard to the caseload update, we virtually have seen probably the most significant financial change in three categories. There is the OHP Plus projects the savings in the parent caretaker relative category. This is what was formerly known as TANF, and of course this corresponds to the same data that you just heard from DHS on in regard to we see a drop in that particular caseload. That's where our significant savings come from. Now again, as we were describing earlier, we see a savings from the general fund amount that was otherwise previously budgeted in December. But again, we attribute that to, from the forecasters, that there's a shift between categories. Some of the TANF population, of course, is leaving because as the economy improves, they are getting jobs, and they're no longer necessarily receiving those benefits, or they're moving into the ACA population, as was described earlier, because the federal poverty level for this group has gone up to the 133. Another area is for aid for the blind and disabled persons. While the amount of change here is relatively small, this category has usually been a rather costly area. And again, the change in the mix of this particular category shows movement between aid to blind and disabled into old age assistance. Again, this is a financially favorable position for the agency, but as Director Saxton was emphasizing, the more data we get behind these forecasts so that we can stabilize this, the better we will be able to project into 15-17. Our children's health insurance program, again, shows a significant savings due to a decline in our monthly average of about 10%. This is the Title 21 program, and it could be attributed to a multiple of factors. Children who are simply aging out of that category, so they're no longer eligible for that element, or have transferred into the ACA population. And in some cases, it can be that they're now basically children who are at below 100% and now are moving into the traditional Medicaid population as well. The change in MAP caseload, this is a summary level slide, basically to show as Director Saxon put it, the turbulence that we've kind of experienced and we're trying to live through from January of last year, and really it sort of amplifies the MAP caseload increase due to the ACA. The shaded dots, as you will see, those are the forecasters' projections based upon monthly increases, or excuse me, monthly data updates, and where in working through the data, they are projecting that as things normalize, as we get through our redeterminations and we actually get back on track with closures, where they would expect the population to normalize over the course of the next biennium. This chart is basically the isolation of the cost changes that we have been describing. And again, you can see the emphasis where the Affordable Care Act, that population increases our federal fund limitation, significant savings in parent, caretaker, relative, as well as aid to blind and disabled. Basically presents us a net budgetary challenge of increasing $28 million, but offset with a $38 million projected general fund savings. Again, the analogy I use is that while we continue to make the CCO payments and we're committed to right-sizing and obviously reviewing our rate setting, this is more an element of which checkbook does the agency make that payment out of. Moving on to the overall budget risks. Again, we're committed to doing the actuarial review. Now, what effect that's going to have for 13-15, my understanding is that because the rates will be probably ready for disclosure by the end of June or 1st of July, we will have already gone through the 13-15 biennium. The rate setting will be prospective from July 1 forward. As noted by Senator Bates, there is a risk to us in 15-17. What do those rates do if they go up or down, and how that affects our projection going into a restate of the governor's budget?
Co-chairs Nathanson and Bates, I just want to interject here because it's a highly controversial topic, and I want to prevent getting 16 phone calls as soon as I get back to my office. There has been no decision made yet about the retroactive nature of the 2015 rate development process. So I just want to clarify that for the record.
Again, the risks in regard to our challenges primarily, of course, are with our caseloads. We're charting new territory. This post-startup adjustments are still necessary as we go through our redeterminations and closure processes. As we refine that and get caught up on that element, we will then better have data in regard to what our caseloads can project going forward. There's continued to be volatility of employment, of course, as the economy recovers and people either move from one category, such as TANF, into ACA, or particularly off the system altogether if they're successful in getting higher paid jobs as well as having access to health care through a qualified health plan. And then lastly, of course, as you know, the challenge we have going forward is the data systems for our eligibility. We need to be able to continue with our implementation of the Kentucky system, now referred to as Oregon 1, it's Oregon eligibility. And as we stay on track with that, that'll hopefully be implemented in time for next spring. The last element, of course, is our revenue projections. Again, tobacco tax, as we started this discussion, continue to have the volatility. And as presented in our rebalance report, you can see the history of where the spikes of the revenue will constantly go up or down, depending upon the economy and or other variables that influence consumption. The Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement, of course, is a significant number that's built into the Oregon Health Plan budget, both for the current biennium as well as next biennium, and we monitor that closely. And then the last element is what's called the Designated State Health Programs, DSHP, which we've discussed in prior settings as well. As we move forward, we project that we're going to balance on the DSHP obligation with our waiver with Center for Medicaid Services for the current biennium. The risk to us, of course, is going into next biennium. Those eligible categories by which we claim DSHP narrows down to what is now referred to as just the traditional. So the OHA budget will need to rely upon significant state-funded areas in the addictions and mental health going forward for the remaining 2 years of the DSHP waiver.
Yes, thank you. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more, Mr. Coulomb, because I need to understand what you just said better than I do. Or maybe Ms. Saxton, or maybe Ms. Moore-Peterson, or somebody, because I'm not quite following you.
So as we came, excuse me, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Sanger Hayward, as we came into this biennium, you may recall we have the $1.9 billion agreement that was negotiated by the former governor with the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. That $1.9 billion agreement was categorized into special areas, such as workforce development, where we leveraged existing state funds or community colleges and universities' expenditures, nothing to do with eligibility, nothing to do with entitlement.
Right.
We leveraged workforce development. We had leveraged the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And then we leveraged what was called traditional DSHP, which really is sort of combing through and finding those other areas of the OHA and DHS budget that hadn't been used for match or maintenance of effort or leveraged in any other way. So that now that we're going down into the 15-17 biennium, all those other categories have gone away. That was part of the stipulation of the waiver. And we step down now into just traditional DSHP, meaning OHA DHS budgets for the remaining leverage going into 15-17.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, we also, as you know, will be bringing forth to you the six-year projection that we're finalizing, which will make that progression clear and help you see the broad context of the interplay between federal and state funding for the health system. So that's forthcoming.
Quick follow-up, if I may. Thank you. Okay, I think I sort of get it, but it sounds like I'm going to need to understand that a little bit better. And if Ms. Saxton, if you think you're going to have something available for us in the near future that will help me wrap my brain around this part of it, I keep thinking I understand this stuff, and then I keep discovering stuff I don't understand. But at least I'm willing to ask questions. So if not, then maybe I can have an offline conversation with somebody to help me understand this a little bit better, because I want to be sure that I'm thinking about it correctly. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Sanger here would be happy to be able to provide that information.
Thank you very
much.
It's
very confusing.
It makes me feel better.
On your revenues here, I don't see the hospital provider assessment. I would like to know how that's going. I think it's a quarterly payment, if I remember right. Is that coming in as we expect?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, thank you for noticing that, because for the 13-15 biennium, it isn't so much a revenue risk as it has actually played out more favorable for the Oregon Health Authority. The payments are, in fact, made quarterly, and the increase over what was previously projected has already been accounted for in the governor's budget for 15-17. Because, of course, being a quarterly payment, we always have at least a 90 to 100-day lag in the receipt of those revenues. But for the 13-15 biennium, we do project that we will be able to meet the revenue that was accounted for in this biennium.
Thank you very much. You know, this does occur to me to wonder, it's essentially analogous to Chair Nathanson's question about tobacco. We are fortunately seeing a significant decrease in hospitalizations for a lot of the populations who have been historically bouncing in and out of the hospital, in particular CCO. The hospital assessment is a percent of total revenue. And so if their total revenues are going down because we aren't hospitalizing people as frequently or for as long, what does that do for us going forward? I mean, don't get me wrong, I love the fact that we're not putting people in the hospital, but it does affect our potential revenue from the hospital assessment. Or am I missing something here again?
Co-chairs Bates and Nathanson, the hospital tax plays a critical role going forward. And again, I'm going to we are meeting this week to finalize the six-year projection. It's really critical, particularly now that the $1.9 billion, we're on the back end of the $1.9 billion. It's really critical to look at the interplay of the hospital tax, of that DSHP role that Bill just so eloquently described, that helped me even. And also the federal funding that falls away for the ACA in the next 6 years. So we are going to schedule those meetings with you all next week. We're going to allow plenty of time and go into a lot of detail because it's the interplay of all the funding sources that really is critical here.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to do a couple follow-up questions on this issue. I think it's one of the key issues in what we'll be looking at the next 6 years. Unfortunately, agreement's only for 4 years, but we'll deal with that when the time comes. Generally speaking, it looks like hospital revenues are up across the board, probably because of population aging and an enlarged population of the state. While rates of hospitalizations and stays have been going down per population, the general population increase, I think, is probably made up for the difference. I think that's what we're probably seeing. The numbers I've seen for hospitals, everything is up, but not per case. They're actually bringing costs down. I really want to see some detail on this when we get a chance. Yes. I think it's really key. With what happened this week with the PERS situation, what our budgets are looking like, and what budgets are going to look like as we go forward, revenue sources are going to become much, much more important. And this particular revenue source may be really the key to keeping this program alive and functioning properly as general fund money becomes much more difficult to obtain. So we really got to take a look at this. I know we're all aware of it. And in 5 or 6 years, we're picking up our 10% of this population. It's going to be concerning. Some of the population movements you've outlined here actually right now save us money. And probably in the long run, the match is better, so it saves us money. But some of them, it's hard to really get a handle on that and how fast they're moving. And I don't think you know for sure where some of these people are going. Did they go to the Affordable Care Act? Did they go to private insurance? Did they just disappear on the insurance field altogether? So lots of unknowns. Whatever data you can give us before we leave is really going to be helpful. We're going to try to set budgets based on some really worrisome risks out there for the next 2 years. February is going to be, I think, very interesting.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, the only other thing that I would mention for Steiner Hayward is that in regard to the hospital tax, you're absolutely correct. As the population ages, it depends upon the length of stay. Hospital revenues, as reported to us, increase. But the other element that we constantly monitor is the adjustment of the actual rate itself, in order to be staying within equilibrium. And so, of course, as that rate is adjusted, that then is, of course, is a benefiting factor for our budget overall.
Thank you.
Okay. And that concludes our presentation for the rebalance.
Thank you for the presentation. We have one person signed up for public testimony, Mr. Mullen.
While we're waiting for Mr. Mullen to come up, I have to say this is one of the slickest things I've ever seen of robbing Peter to pay Paul. I think this is what he's. I don't know why this didn't go back in the general fund, then come back to us. I think this was just a way of moving the money so nobody else could get a crack at it, you know.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen from the Oregon Law Center. I'd like to testify briefly on this, the rebalance, and specifically about the SPA rebalance inside of Department of Human Services. I'm going to be as concise as possible, but this actually has two tracks to it that I want to bring to everybody's attention. First of all, as I think everybody that was around from 2009 forward knew about the crisis that existed in the Senior Disabled Property Tax Deferral Program. Changes happened to cut thousands, literally thousands of people out of the program. A number of advocates, including the work that I did and working with members, we worked to get people reinstated into that program over time. The last reinstatement of people that didn't know they were eligible to reapply, we left about 700 people out of the program, got an opportunity to reapply, but those folks did not have their property taxes paid as a part of that getting back into the Senior Disabled Property Tax Deferral Program. These are people that are low income and are trying to stay in their own home. The second track that I want to just mention that's related to all of this is the change that the legislature made in the senior medical deduction. I was also very much involved in that. It became part of what people refer to as the grand bargain. The changes that happened to that program saved $82 million this biennium. The agreement from the co-chairs of Full Ways and Means was to reinvest $41 million back into programs for seniors and people with disabilities. As you may recall, there was $10 million off the top for Oregon Project Independence, $5 million off the top for special needs transportation, and then the leftover was the $26 million SPA. As part of the $26 million SPA, I worked to get one of the provisions in there to provide property tax relief for those people that got back into the program, very vulnerable people that are in need of assistance. Had no way of knowing how many people might apply for that program, estimated at about 50 people. It turns out we served 45 people through that program, and the money was completely spent out. Multnomah County Aging and Disability Services stepped up to do the program for people statewide. They did a really terrific and admirable job. Right now, there are at least 140 people on a waiting list with documentation that would make them eligible, but for the fact that the funds are completely spent out. I appreciate the fact that Aaron Kelly Seal mentioned the issue about the SPA rebalance. You know that there's $3.6 million estimated in savings in the SPA rebalance. Questions have arisen about the confidence level in that. Of course, the savings could be even greater than $3.6 million. I've looked at the details and the information, and some of it is not contained in the rebalance. For example, addictions and mental health has a part of the SPA. And while they have committed in contracts, I think that because that was late in getting started up, there'll be savings there as well. So the reason I wanted to have an opportunity to testify is that I would ask for consideration on the part of the subcommittee to take a portion of that, the rebalance within the SPA, and commit it to this property tax deferral program. I have to say that people contact me about this. I have a 91-year-old woman who contacts me every couple of weeks and asks me how things are going. I've sent a fair amount of material to you, Madam Co-Chair, and Mr. Co-Chair about this, and I know your staff has looked at it. I've talked to the co-chairs of Full Ways and Means as well. In conclusion, I would just say that senior medical, the changes there was a commitment on the part of the legislature to reinvest in programs. The connecting issue to the property tax deferral program where you had to make hard decisions, but then there was opportunities to get people back. This is a one-time only situation. In other words, once we take care of people that are on the waiting list, this issue goes away. So I just thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Manager, what's the cost of clearing the waiting list?
For the 140 that have documentation, it's a little shade under $800,000. There's an additional number of people that we don't know whether they would have the proper documentation to get back into the program. So I would say at a minimum, including the 91-year-old lady that contacts me, the population of about 140 would be possible to serve those people before the end of the biennium.
Paula,
yes.
My understanding of the program, correct me if I'm wrong, John, is it's once you get this program going again and there's enough equity in the homes, it's a revolving account, basically.
Yes.
And that's what we got us in trouble, is the cost of values of homes drop so low that we're in trouble on the program.
Mr. Co-Chair,
values are now back up, and it's a revolving account, so we get these people back, and there's not an ongoing cost to us in the future, unless we have another crash in the housing market, which is that seems a little unlikely.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, that's stated very well. You know, what happened to the corpus of the deferral program is it was used on a couple of occasions. Once it was swept, and once it was used to backfill Oregon Project Independence, and then the housing market crashed. So we had a kind of a perfect storm about the deferral program.
Thank you. In other words, we did it to ourselves. Thank you.
Senator Bates, Mr. Co-Chair.
It's a consideration, but we're ready to rebalance right now. Only way I could think of doing this would be to do it in full, but we have to talk to a lot of other people before we do something. It really is important that these are brought to us not at the last minute, but that a week or two ahead of time, so we can be working to the overall budget, because if you start doing it for you, we'll have to do it for everybody.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I did provide information, and I tried my best to just give the information and hope that it would be part of the overall consideration. So I apologize if I didn't get enough information to members of the committee.
Senator Bates, I've asked Ms. Byerly to respond to a question I just posed.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, I have seen information from Mr. Mullen, and I am well aware that the Joint Ways and Means Co-Chairs have seen it. This issue has been discussed. I don't believe there was an expectation to deal with it at this time as part of the DHS and OHA rebalance. However, I think there's knowledge that this is a problem. I think there's a desire to try and make those people whole. There are additional opportunities within the current biennium and bills later in session to address it, as well as a possibility of addressing it in 1517. I'm not aware that those decisions have been made. I think, as Mr. Mullen mentioned, the senior property deferral account itself is healthier now, and there may be a way to use part of that to address the issue as well. And just for clarification, these people, Senator Bates, are already back in the program. This piece here is to pay those back taxes that did not get covered when they were reinstated. And as Mr. Mullen said, the original estimate was much lower than what we anticipated as far as who actually came forward and what those back taxes amounts were.
Correct.
So.
Thank you, Ms. Byerly. So the bottom line is, this isn't the end of the story today. There's a possibility of addressing it at another point.
And just another thing I'd like to point out. Mr. Mullen was talking about the senior purpose or the special purpose appropriation for seniors. We're taking a look at sort of what that body of work is going forward. We've then identified what is actually still sort of in the base budgets of agencies to address those issues, and looking to try and make sure that that is addressed in 1517 as well. And so I think there's a possibility there's maybe room in that discussion to address this issue as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mullen. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Yes, Representative.
Yeah, I would just like to weigh in support for dealing with this at the appropriate time. This was a huge issue that happened right as I was being appointed three and a half years ago, and people were getting their property taxes. And I believe there's a 6% interest rate that is also charged, so I'm assuming that would hold for paying 6% interest when it's finally repaid, when the person sells the house or the estate sells the house. So I do hope that we can deal with this later in the session.
Thank you, Representative. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 5043. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 5043. Yes, Ms. Byerly.
Madam.
Please present us with LFO's recommendation.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee. So in OLIS today, there's also a recommendation memo from Linda and I. It basically incorporates the presentation you heard today from the agency, as well as what they laid out in their letters to the committee. So just real quickly, I loaned you my piece of paper. Sorry. So the memo goes through section by section. It talks about what the pieces of the budget are. So I would just like to summarize for the Department of Human Services the action that is laid out for you in the -1 amendment to House Bill 5043, which is a blank bill. So this would take that blank bill and put these adjustments into it. For the Department of Human Services, it adds a net increase of $892,806. General fund, which is the transfer from the Oregon Health Authority to Human Services. And there's also an expenditure increases of $13,794.42 other funds expenditure limitation and $47,316,842 federal funds expenditure limitation. Those actions will bring the agency into balance for the current biennium. Again, acknowledging that there are risks that were discussed earlier and are laid out in the memo as well, I would not be surprised if we would need to deal with a closeout rebalance in 2015. Last session, we didn't have to do that, but we may need to do that for these agencies, as you heard today.
Oh, we're always here and happy to reconvene for additional meetings.
And I think my counterpart would like to.
Okay.
Yes.
And Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, on the OHA side of the rebalance, LFO recommends a decrease of $40.6 million general fund. That includes the little less than $900,000 that will go to DHS. A decrease of $11.5 million other funds expenditure limitation, and an increase of $77.6 million federal funds limitation. And again, that is what is included in the Dash 1 amendment.
Don't need no stinking piece of paper from you.
Is there a motion?
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 5043.
Thank you. There is a motion on the table. Discussion of the motion. Yes, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I tried to follow along with Lori's analysis, and I couldn't find any of those numbers, but I found close numbers. So I'm wondering if they were, is that a permutation of?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Boone, what you're looking at in the amendment are the pieces broken out by appropriation. And so the numbers I gave you were the agency-wide figures.
Okay.
And they're in the first paragraph of the memo that was written out. But that's what you're seeing, pieces in the amendment, because they are at sub-appropriation adjustments.
Okay, thanks. Okay.
Other discussion on the motion? Representative.
So this is to rebalance our current through July 1st, correct? So when we talk about taking TANF savings and putting it toward aging disability, we're not discussing the $30 million projected savings for the next biennium. That's to be discussed at another time.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Kindergarten, that is correct.
Thank you for that clarification.
This is simply to rebalance the current biennium.
Thank you.
End of June.
Thank you. Are there objections? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 5043 as amended to the Full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Discussion? Objections?
Madam Chair, I'm going to vote for it, but I do want a specificity on the issue that was raised with respect to the caseloads for the in-home personal funds. And what I would like to have back is the answer to two questions. One, when was this policy discussion held by this body? And two, whether or not the K waiver was also a part of this or not. Because it's troubling that we've got over a 2,000 increase in caseload here at a cost that we can't sustain. So, you know, for me, I think I need to have some clarity on when this was discussed and approval was granted that we go down this pathway for that the kind of increase that's in this particular category. So I would like to have that information, and I will give this courtesy before we go to vote.
Thank you. We'll make sure that happens, Senator Winters. Other discussion? Objections to the motion? Motion passes.
I guess it's my turn.
It's going to be your Friday.
Well, we won't. It'll probably be next Friday.
It'll be next Friday.
It's my turn. I'll take care of it. Okay. Anything else?
And we'll need carriers for full in the House or the Senate in the House, too.
Conversation. I'll take it this way.
Yeah, me too.
To anyone else?
But you want me to take it?
No, I'll take
it. You take it.
Or you got the SRB?
That's right.
Just don't look at me like
carriers. I'm going to close the work session now. Okay, I'm closing the work session. On House Bill 5043, I am opening an informational meeting, Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Authority, caseload adjustments. Well, this ought to be just dandy.
And Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, again, there are two more presentations in OLIS for you that they'll be putting up on the screen. There's one for both, one for DHS and one for Oregon Health Authority.
And my computer is back.
It's back.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll be right back.
Good day, Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Bates, members of the committee. My name is Eric Moore. I'm the DHS CFO. And today we're trying to, I'll try to move quickly through our forecast changes for 15-17. And what we've put together is really the major changes from the 13-15 budget to the 15-17 budget and those forecasted changes. In general, this first slide shows the general changes from fall, the fall 14.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second. On this presentation, is it correct that we have 11 slides? And we have another presentation,
yes.
So we're going to have to move quickly to make sure each of you has time.
I plan to move quickly. This is the general slide. I'd only like to say that in general, the drivers for our forecasts are policy changes, the economy, and demographics. This biennium, they've had impacts over the forecast that have been difficult to predict, especially with the major policy changes this biennium in APD and DD, and for federal policy changes that are set to occur in the vocational rehabilitation system. The first slide is an overview of the SNAP forecast. There really isn't much much change in the forecast. It's an average of 419,753 cases that are anticipated for next biennium. This doesn't drive the programmatic budget, but does influence our workload, which is why we have the slide in this particular presentation. The TANF overview caseload. TANF has had a significant drop of about 3.4% from the fall forecast. Caseloads are falling due to a combination of vigorous case management, which is closing cases at a fast pace, and an improving economy. Child welfare caseload overview. The basics are that we've got a slight increase in moderate growth in guardianship assistance and adoption assistance, with the child out-of-home and in-home caseloads anticipated to have a moderate reduction. Overall, while traditional caseloads are lower than the fall forecast, projections in the number of screenings that staff have to go out to are increasing, and which has an impact on our workload model. For vocational rehabilitation services, there really isn't much of a change from this biennium's budget. The one thing I would point out is that this forecast does not include any of the WIOA, Workforce Investment Opportunity Act, comments, program policy changes that the feds have just put out. There's about 2,000 pages worth of regulations that they have to go through that haven't been included in this forecast. So we don't know what's going to happen when we get to that place of figuring out what those changes will do to us.
Once again, co-chair is Mike McCormick with the Department of Human Services. As been discussed this morning, the majority of the caseload growth in 15-17 in the APD program is attributable to the in-home growth. And what we're seeing is this is the effects of the baby boomers entering our programs. We're also, the $500 over SSI policy is having an impact on this population as well as individuals that are newly eligible under the Affordable Care Act are ultimately eligible for these services, provided that they meet our level of care criteria, meaning that they can substantiate their needs. So those are the three major reasons for why this caseload is increasing.
For the adult intellectual and developmental disabilities program, the comprehensive in-home services caseload is projected to grow due to an increase in adults in the caseload. This is due effectively to a cap on the brokerages and is the major driver of the DD reshoot budget.
This takes my breath away.
Yes, Representative Kenny Geyer would like an explanation.
Can you explain the cap on the brokerages and how that impacts this?
Sure. Co-chairs, members of the committee, there was a Staley lawsuit settlement that occurred in Oregon many years ago, and as part of that, all adults became eligible for what used to be capped support services. And at that time, the brokerage system was developed to support those adults. With our support services waiver, We have an amendment was submitted that caps or holds steady the number of adults that the brokerages can serve at about 7,800 total. And what's happened is that we've had now with the K plan, and these are adults we would be serving otherwise or anyway as a result of this daily lawsuit, instead of many of them going into brokerages, had we continued that upward trajectory and increased the capacity for brokerages in our waiver, they would probably be in the brokerage system. But because of the K plan and their ability to be served now through CDDPs, these adults are showing up in this particular caseload. So it's these are adults that likely that would have been served through the brokerage system in the prior in the past in the prior system, and now are being served under this service element, which is for CDDPs. And my name is Lilia Tennanty. I'm the director of the Office of Developmental Disability Services, for the record. Thank you.
So you can say it all over again.
Yeah.
I'm just
yes, Representative.
So if we were to see a graph with people that are served through the brokerage system, would it be flat?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, yes. It would be holding steady at about 7,800, because that's the number that we have approved for through CMS for the brokerage system.
So follow up. Yeah, this is still a huge increase.
Mm-hmm. Members of the committee, Representative Kinnegar, yes. It is an increase, and what had occurred in the past is there was in that waiver amendment a projection of an increase over the 5 years of approval, ending, if I recall the number correctly, with about 9,800 people served through the brokerages through the Staley settlement. However, when an amendment was submitted over a year ago now, it changed that trajectory and held it down at 7,800. And so we're still required to serve these individuals because they meet our eligibility requirements, and not only as a result of the Staley settlement, but also because of the K plan. And so now a lot of these services are being provided, the services are being provided through our community developmental disability programs, or CDDPs.
We need to move on for right now. But I know that it's something that we should keep reviewing.
Thank you.
Okay, and this is effectively the last slide. This is just a quick overview of the impact of the caseload and reshoot cost changes in each of the program areas. You can see that for the most part, we've got a decrease in self-sufficiency due to the spring forecast. Child welfare has an increase due to the increased workload based on the number of screenings that we have to go out for. There's no changes in the VR forecast at this time. The APD forecast has an increase of $32.4 million, generated primarily by the caseload and cost per case increases due to the spring forecast. And the same thing in the intellectual and developmental disabilities program, an $18.1 million general fund increase. Each of these also includes a change, as indicated in the FMAP rate, that was a favorable change to the department.
Okay.
And if you have any questions, the forecast itself, the link is on the last page to the forecast.
You know, we can keep working more efficiently and more effectively, and the staff develop new ways to deliver services in a way that's very sensitive to clients' needs. We can do the best we can, and still we get faced with things outside our control that drive either our cost per case or our caseload up. It's a really tough position to be in, and I just want to let you all know that we recognize that, and you keep working really hard, and you keep trying, and it's difficult, but I understand.
Thank you, Coach.
Okay, let's the next presentation.
Eligibility was the other thing. And I think that's what they've been asking about.
We'll have about 8 minutes.
All right.
Let's start.
We will go quickly. You want me to stay? Just dive in. Hi, for the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the Medicaid director for with the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here to present on the spring caseload forecast changes for the 15-17 biennium for the medical assistance programs, in other words, the Oregon Health Plan caseload. If you will look at that first slide. It includes both medical assistance programs and addictions and mental health, and just shows you overall the change. And you know, I think that I can move through my presentation relatively quickly because most of the factors that were influencing the 13-15 changes to the caseload, they're the same ones that are influencing going forward with the 15-17 caseload. So the primary takeaway is that we have more people into the ACA adult category than the other categories. And so consequently, even though the overall caseload may be higher than what was originally projected, the overall financial impact is that we have a greater need for federal funds and less of a need for other kinds of state funds, including general fund. The overall total medical assistance programs, the reason that you see those the sharp increase there is a combination of second open enrollment for health insurance. And even though every day is an open enrollment day for Medicaid, we still see a large influx of people coming in during that time period who hear about coverage and are seeking coverage and then wind up qualifying for the Oregon Health Plan. It's combined with the fact that we did have deferrals in our and late closures, and so we were in the middle of doing all of our redetermination processes as well. So it's a combination of a lot more people coming in, fewer people leaving, and so consequently the caseload grew at a very sharp rate. We are projecting that to come down as we complete and continue to work on our redetermination and renewal processes, which will be happening over the next few months through this summer. All right, these are some individual caseloads. As I mentioned, there's a large increase in the number of ACA adults. It's also one of those populations that it is taking us a great deal of staff time and work time to be able to go through the renewal process for this particular population. We also are seeing a reduction in our parent relative caretaker, which is the former TANF population. You know, that graph looks incredibly odd, but we are anticipating that as they go through the thank you, Bill's point. The scale. Pay attention to the scale. And as a numbers kind of geek, that you do have to pay attention to the left hand scale, which exaggerates the differences here in both of those graphs. But we are anticipating that as we go through the renewal and redetermination process, again, we will start to see many of those individuals transitioning either off the program as they have employment or have other access to other insurance, or they move into the ACA adult population, which is a higher income level. This particular population, the income level is it's actually a dollar figure, but it's the equivalent of about 42% of the federal poverty level, so it's very low. The next one on the age of the blind and disabled, we are seeing steady, actually, some increases, but we've actually been seeing steady decreases, and that we anticipate that's largely because a lot of them are now in the ACA adult category. They are still being assessed as to whether they have needs for either long-term care supports and services, or
they are not seeking to qualify for disability, and are because they have access to health insurance without needing to qualify for disability. So we do know that a lot of individuals who prior to the implementation of the ACA were without health insurance and they may have had chronic health conditions, et cetera, and so they would seek to be disabled in order to get access and go through that very laborious process to get disability in order to qualify their health insurance. And if they were on the bubble for that, and now really what they really needed was access to health insurance, then they don't need to go through those additional steps. So we are anticipating that trend stabilizing over time. And that we won't see as large of increases in the age of the blind, age of the disabled categories as we were seeing in the past. I know you're, and we'll probably see it relative to the population growth, but not necessarily because people are seeking disability.
We're waiting till the end for questions.
Oh, okay. I apologize. I missed that.
At least
nope, that's fine. Go ahead. And I can. It's not a big deal. Mine's
fine. Thank you. Five more slides.
Sure. No problem. I can skip.
So, I'm actually going to the breast and cervical cancer. It's graph here. It's also we're seeing the same sorts of things. There's a lot more women now who already have health insurance, so the overall need for this particular program has gone down, and so the women flowing in needing treatment services is going down. The pregnant women. That's largely a result of the delays that we've been facing in the redetermination and process, and also we simply as was described before, there's a lot of turbulence, as Dr. Sexton outlined, or unknowns about what this program is, and so we are about this. About our overall caseload, there's a lot of unknowns, and so we don't know yet what the new normal is going to be, and so this is there's a lot of risk associated with this particular forecast. With that, I will turn it over to my colleague.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Mike Morris, and I'm the Behavioral Health Policy Administrator, and I can do that presentation in 2 minutes. So, we were required in the budget report to look at our caseload forecasting methodology, and this is a reporting on that change. Our old methodology was based upon utilization in residential programs primarily, and then during budgetary tight times, we cut back on our development of residential programs. Therefore, the number of people in residentials didn't climb as expected, and so it really did not capture what the need was, but just captured our capacity. And so we wanted to change the methodology to look at what the actual need is for the mandated population, civilly committed and forensically committed. So.
That's a significant change in approach.
Yes.
That's a very big deal.
So this, the methodology, let me discuss the methodology and then I'll go back to the graph, is the new methodology. It looks at our mandated caseloads into four different categories: those that are currently mandated through either guilty, except for insanity, aid and assist, or civil committed. Those who had been previously mandated and those who had never been mandated, but we are serving those in our system. So the new pricing, new methodology is to look at those categories and then to actually count individuals who have been mandated and to develop a number and to see the actual growth in those populations. We currently are focused in on the mandated population, which is the guilty except for insanity, where haven't tackled aid and assist, but the civil commitment population is what we've been using for budgeting. So the besides that is then we looked at the pricing methodology, and so we looked at the numbers that were of individuals being served in those population groups, and then developed a per member per month methodology. So we looked at all the services that were general fund services, not the Medicaid funded services, and came up with a methodology for coming up with that rate and then applying that rate to the population category. And so in the future, what we hope to do is to refine our methodology even further with some of our data system, our measuring outcomes and tracking system, which will give us the non-Medicaid encounters of specific services, so we'll be able to better target those services and price those and develop a budget regarding those. And so that's in the future, and eventually we'd like to look at caseload growth for children, mental health and alcohol and drug, as well as alcohol and drug services for adults. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for getting through that so quickly. Are there any questions that anyone wants to put on the record? We don't have time for the responses, but we can get the questions on the record and you can send us responses. Representative Boone.
Thank you. And it's an easy one, I'm sure, but I just didn't get it. The difference between the Medicaid children and CHIP children. And it looks like it's kind of a wash between them, but, you know, up or down. But just wondered how that's how are those figured? Because I thought they were the same.
Senator Steiner-Hayward, could you have a question you want on the record?
Not on the record. Thank you very much.
Representative.
I just wanted to know if the one that had pregnant women included the Cowan population.
The what?
Cowan population.
And we'll get a response to that.
Did not.
Thank you very much for rushing through at the end, and I appreciate everyone's participation today. I'm closing the informational meeting, and I'm closing and adjourning this meeting.
Tomorrow I want a policy bill.
This meeting.